Okay, can I ask you to settle down and welcome you on behalf of the Center for Human Rights and the Gender Institute to tonight's public lecture. My name's Anne Phillips and I'm director of the Gender Institute, and it's my very great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Martha Nussbaum, who's the Professor of Law and Ethics at the University of Chicago. And I imagine is known to each of us from rather different parts of her work, because her work spans, you know, such an enormous range across ancient Greek philosophy, contemporary moral and political philosophy, feminism, literature, development. However, I imagine she's also known to all of us as someone who combines deep scholarship with a very compelling sense of the ethical and political responsibilities of intellectuals. So she's a public intellectual in the very best sense of the term. There's a rather stern notice on the Chicago website which says that Professor Nussbaum is on research leave this year and won't be able to take on any speaking engagements. But this is a case where the message is far sterner than the practice. And in fact, she's been enormously generous of her time and energies at LSE today. She's already given two seminars on cosmopolitan duties, Cicero's problematic legacy, and hiding from humanity, shame and the law. And I'm very delighted now to hand over to her to give tonight's lecture on sex equality, entitlements, and the capabilities approach.
Well, thank you very much, and it's an enormous pleasure to be here, and thank you all for coming. I'm having a great time getting questions and feedback on my work in progress here. So this paper is an attempt to reflect about the capabilities approach, the relationship between the version of it that I for some time have been working out and the version that Amartya Sen has been working out, because now this approach is in many ways catching on and it's attracting attention from people in a wide variety of disciplines, and yet there are these two approaches for it, and this paper was actually commissioned for a special issue of the journal Feminist Economics that will be coming out next year in about Sen's work, so that is one reason for the focus on him. But I think I was just trying to get straight in my own mind about some of the issues that lie behind this approach, and of course issues of sex equality are very central among those, so it's natural to retain that focus. Throughout his career, Amartya Sen has been preoccupied with questions of social justice. Inequalities between women and men have been especially important in his thinking, and the achievement of gender justice in society has been one of the most central goals of his theoretical enterprise. Against the dominant emphasis on economic growth as an indicator of a nation's quality of life, Sen has insisted on the importance of capabilities, that is, what people are actually able to do and to be. Frequently, his arguments in favor of this shift in our thinking deal with issues of gender. Growth is a bad indicator of life quality because it fails to tell us how the most deprived people in society are doing. Women figure in this argument as people who are often unable to enjoy the fruits of a nation's general prosperity. If we ask what people are actually able to do and to be, we come much closer to understanding the barriers societies have erected against full justice for women. Similarly, Sen criticizes approaches that measure well-being in terms of utility by pointing to the fact that women frequently exhibit what he calls adaptive preferences, preferences that have adjusted to their second-class status. Thus, the utilitarian framework, which asks people what they currently prefer and how satisfied they are, proves inadequate again to confront the most pressing issues of gender justice. We can only have an adequate theory of gender justice and of social justice more generally if we're willing to make claims about fundamental entitlements of all persons that are to some extent independent of the preferences that people happen to have, preferences shaped often by unjust background conditions. This critique of dominant paradigms in terms of ideas of gender justice is a pervasive feature in Sen's work, and it's obvious that one central motivation for his elaboration of the capabilities approach is its superior potential for developing a theory of gender justice. But the reader who looks for a fully formulated account of social justice generally and gender justice in particular in Sen's work will not find one. She will need to extrapolate one from the suggestive materials that Sen provides. Development as Freedom, his most recent book, develops one pertinent line of thought, arguing that capabilities provide the best basis for thinking about the normative goals of development, both when nations are compared by international measures of welfare and when each nation strives internally to achieve a higher level of development for its people. Capabilities provide us with an attractive way, he argues, of understanding the normative content of the idea of development, which, of course, he's always stressed, is a normative concept in the sense that it means that things are getting better. Thinking of development's goal as merely increase in GNP per capita occluded distributional inequalities, particularly central when we're thinking about sex equality. It also failed to disaggregate and separately consider important aspects of development, such as health and education, that are demonstrably not well correlated with GNP, even when we take distribution into account. That's also shown very clearly by his more empirical book on India, which he co-authored with Jean Drez. Thinking of development's goal in terms of utility at least has the merit of looking at what processes do for people. But utility, Sen argues, is inadequate to capture the heterogeneity and the non-commensurability of the diverse aspects of human development. Because it fails to take account of the fact of adaptive preferences, it also biases the development process in favor of the status quo when used as a normative benchmark. Finally, it suggests that the goal of development is a state or condition of persons, most classically a state of satisfaction, and thus understates the importance of agency and freedom in the development process. Again, a very pertinent issue for women. So all these failings, he then stresses, loom large when we confront the theory with inequalities based on sex. For women's lives reflect a striving after many different elements of well-being, including health, education, mobility, political participation, land rights, and others. Women's current preferences often show distortions that are the result of unjust background conditions. And agency and freedom are particularly important goals for women who have so often been treated merely as passive dependents. Not surprisingly, I endorse these arguments, but I think they do not take us very far in thinking about social justice. They give us a general sense of what societies ought to be striving to achieve, but because of Sen's reluctance to make commitments about substance, that is, which capabilities a society ought most centrally to pursue, even that guidance remains an outline. And they give us no sense of what a minimum level of capability for a just society might be. The use of capabilities in development is typically comparative merely, as in the human development reports of the UN Development Program. Thus, nations are compared, as you know if you read these reports, in areas such as health and educational attainment, but concerning what level of health service or educational provision a fully just society would deliver as a fundamental entitlement of all its citizens, the view is suggestive but basically silent. Another famous line of argument pursued by Sen in works from Equality of What to Inequality Reexamined seems more closely linked to concerns of social justice. This argument begins from the idea of equality as a central political value. Most states, he says, consider equality important, and yet they often do not ask perspicuously enough what the right space is within which to make the relevant comparisons. With arguments closely related to his arguments about the goals of development, Sen then argues that the space of capabilities provides the most fruitful and ethically satisfactory way of looking at equality as a political goal. Equality of utility or welfare falls short for the reasons I've already summarized. Equality of resources falls short because it fails to take account of the fact that individuals have differing needs for resources if they are to come up to the same level of capability to function. They also have differing abilities to convert resources into actual functioning. Some of these differences are straightforwardly physical. A child needs more protein than an adult to achieve a similar level of healthy functioning, and a pregnant woman needs more nutrients than a non-pregnant woman. But the differences that most interest Sen are social, connected with entrenched discrimination of various kinds. Thus, in a nation where women are traditionally discouraged from pursuing an education, it will usually take more resources to produce female literacy than male literacy. Or, to cite Sen's famous example from Equality of What, a person in a wheelchair will require more resources connected with mobility than will the person with so-called normal mobility if the two are to attain a similar level of ability to get around in that society. Although Sen tends to treat this example as one of straightforward physical difference, I believe that we should not so treat it, for the reasons that the wheelchair person is not able to get around are thoroughly social. Sen's arguments about equality seem to have the following bearing on issues of social justice and public policy. To the extent that a society values the equality of persons and pursues these as among its social goals, equality of capabilities looks like the most relevant sort of equality to aim at. And it's clear that equality is a central goal for women who pursue social justice. Once again, then, the arguments have particular force and relevance in the context of feminism. But Sen never says to what extent equality of capability ought to be a social goal or how it ought to be combined with other political values in the pursuit of social justice. Now, I think, obviously, the case for this as a goal depends very much both on what capability we're considering and on how we describe it. Thus, equality of capability seems to be very important when we consider the right to vote, the freedom of religion, and so on. But if we consider the capability to play basketball, it seems ludicrous to suppose that society should be very much concerned about even a minimum threshold level of it, much less complete equality. With something like health, much hangs on whether we define the relevant capability as access to the social basis of health, or rather the ability to be healthy. The former seems like something that a just society should distribute on a basis of equality. The latter contains an element of chance that no just society could or should altogether eliminate. So the question whether equality of capability is a good social goal there cannot be well answered without specifying an account of the relevant capabilities. So that gets further developed in a later part of this paper. Now, in this paper, I'm going to suggest that the capabilities approach is indeed a valuable way to approach the question of fundamental entitlements, one that's especially pertinent to issues of sex equality. I'll argue, however, that the capabilities approach will supply definite and useful guidance and prove an ally in the pursuit of sex equality in law and public policy, only if we do formulate a definite list of the most central capabilities, even one that is tentative, humble, and revisable, using capabilities so defined to elaborate a partial account of social justice, that is, a set of basic entitlements without which no society can lay claim to justice. Now, since this is a human rights lecture, I will now briefly reflect on the relationship between the capabilities approach and the human rights approach, the two of which I see as profoundly complementary. The capabilities that Sen mentions in illustration of his approach, and those that I include in my more explicit list, include many of the entitlements that are also stressed in the human rights movement: political liberties, the freedom of association, the free choice of occupation, and a variety of economic and social rights. And capabilities, like human rights, supply a moral and humanly rich set of goals for international development in place of what Marx so nicely called the wealth and poverty of the economists. Thus, capabilities have a very close relationship to human rights as understood in contemporary international discussions. In effect, they cover the terrain covered by both the so-called first-generation rights, political and civil rights, and the so-called second-generation rights, the economic and social rights. And they play a similar role, providing both a basis for cross-cultural comparison and the philosophical underpinning for basic constitutional principles. Both Sen and I connect the capabilities approach closely to the idea of human rights, and in Women and Human Development, I've described the relationship between the two ideas at some length. The human rights approach has sometimes been criticized by feminists for being male-centered and for not including as fundamental entitlements some abilities and opportunities that are fundamental to women in their struggle for sex equality. Women have proposed adding to international rights documents such rights as the right to bodily integrity, the right to be free from violence in the home and from sexual harassment in the workplace. My list of capabilities explicitly incorporates such proposals, and Sen's would appear to do so implicitly. But the theoretical reasons for supplementing the language of rights with this newer language of capabilities still require comment. Capabilities, I would argue, are very closely linked to human rights, but I think the language of capabilities gives important precision and supplementation to the language of rights. The idea of human rights is by no means a crystal clear idea. rights have been understood in many different ways, and difficult theoretical questions are frequently obscured by the use of rights language, which can give the illusion of agreement where there really is deep philosophical disagreement. People differ, for example, about what the basis of a rights claim is. Rationality, sentience, and mere life have all had their defenders. They differ, too, about whether rights are pre-political or artifacts of laws and institutions. They differ about who has the duties correlated to human rights, and so on. The capabilities approach, as it's more fully elaborated elsewhere, has the advantage of taking clear positions on these disputed issues while stating clearly what the motivating concerns are and what the goal is. The relationship between the two notions, however, still needs further scrutiny given the dominance of rights language in international feminism, so I'll just now make a couple of the pertinent points. When we think about fundamental rights, I would argue that the most fruitful way of thinking about what it is to secure them to people is to think in terms of people's capabilities. The right to political participation, the right to religious free exercise, the right of free speech, these and others are all best thought of as secured to citizens only when the relevant capabilities to function are present. In other words, to secure a right to citizens in these areas is to put them in a position of capability to function in that area. To the extent that rights are used in defining social justice, we should not grant that the society is a just one unless the capabilities have been effectively achieved. Of course, people may have a pre-political entitlement to good treatment in this area that has not yet been recognized or implemented, or it may be recognized formally and yet not implemented. But by defining the securing of rights in terms of capabilities, we make it clear that people in a given country don't really have an effective right to political participation, for example, a right in the sense that matters for judging that the society is a just one, simply because this language exists on paper. They really have been given a right only if there are effective measures to make people truly capable of political exercise, and thus a measure of the material support that's needed enters into the analysis even of the political and social rights. Women in many nations have a nominal right of political participation without having this right in the sense of capability and often for material reasons. For example, they may be threatened with violence should they leave the home and thereby deprived of access to employment opportunities, information about their society, and other things that are quite fundamental to their political status. In short, thinking in terms of capabilities gives us a set of benchmarks as we think what it really is to secure a right to someone. It makes clear that this involves affirmative material and institutional support, not simply a failure to impede. We see here, I think, a major advantage of the capabilities approach over understandings of rights, very influential and widespread, certainly in the US above all, that derive from the tradition within liberalism that's now called neoliberal, for which the key idea is that of negative liberty. Often, fundamental entitlements have been understood as prohibitions against interfering state action. And if the state keeps its hands off of people, those rights are taken to have been secured. The state has no further affirmative task. Indeed, if one reads the US Constitution, one sees this conception directly. For negative phrasing concerning state action predominates, as in the text of our First Amendment, which goes as follows: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and petition the government for a redress of grievances. Similarly, our 14th Amendment's all-important guarantees are also stated in terms of what the state may not do. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. This phraseology, deriving from the Enlightenment tradition of negative liberty, leaves things notoriously indeterminate as to whether impediments supplied by the market or by private actors who discriminate are to be considered violations of the fundamental rights of citizens. And I am not suggesting that the US tradition is simple on this. I think that it's actually very complex, but it's been a struggle to get recognition that equal protection pertains to those other situations. The Indian Constitution, by contrast, typically specifies its fundamental rights affirmatively. Thus, for example, in Article 19, all citizens shall have the right to freedom of speech and expression, to assemble peaceably and without arms, to form associations or unions, and then it goes on and on. There's quite a long list. These locutions have usually been understood by courts and others to imply that impediments supplied by non-state actors may also be deemed violative of constitutional rights. Moreover, the Indian Constitution is quite explicit that affirmative action programs to aid the lower castes and women are not only not incompatible with constitutional guarantees, not only do they not supply a kind of interfering state action that's unconstitutional, but they're actually fully in the spirit of the fundamental rights. Such an approach seems very important for gender justice. The state needs to take affirmative action if traditionally marginalized groups are to achieve full equality. Whether a nation has a written constitution or not, it should understand fundamental entitlements in this way. The capabilities approach, we may now say, sides with the Indian Constitution and against the neoliberal interpretation, at any rate, of the U.S. Constitution. It makes it clear that securing a right to someone requires more than the absence of negative state action. Measures such as the recent constitutional amendments in India that guarantee women one-third representation in the local panchayats or village councils, in fact, inspired and to some extent publicly defended in terms of Ann Phillips's work on the politics of presence, are strongly suggested by the capabilities approach, which directs government to think from the start about what obstacles there are to full and effective empowerment for all citizens and to devise measures that address these obstacles. A further advantage of the capabilities approach is that by focusing from the start on what people are actually able to do and to be, it is well placed to foreground and address inequalities that women suffer inside the family. Inequalities in resources and opportunities, educational deprivations, the failure of their work in the home to be recognized as work, insults to their bodily integrity. Traditional rights talk has neglected these issues, and I believe this is no accident, for rights language is strongly linked with the traditional liberal distinction between a public sphere which the state regulates and a private sphere which it must leave alone. If we have the language of capabilities, do we also need the language of rights? The language of rights still plays, I believe, an important role in public discourse, despite its problematic features. When used as in the sentence, "This person has a right to have the basic political liberties secured to her by her government," this sentence reminds us that people have justified and urgent claims to certain types of treatment, no matter what the world around them has done about that. It imports the idea of an urgent claim based upon justice. This is an important thing, particularly for women who may lack explicitly recognized political rights. However, the capabilities approach can make this idea of a fundamental entitlement clear in other ways, particularly, as I shall be arguing, by operating with an account of the capabilities which are held to be fundamental entitlements of all citizens based upon justice. Now, then, to the main issue. One obvious difference between Sen's writings and my own is that for some time I've endorsed a specific list of the central human capabilities as a focus both for comparative quality of life measurement and for the formulation of basic political principles of the sort that can play a role in fundamental constitutional guarantees. And you have the current version of the list, which of course often changes and evolves. The basic idea of my version of the capabilities approach in women and human development and elsewhere is that we begin with a conception of the dignity of the human being and of a life that is worthy of that dignity, a life that has available in it truly human functioning in the sense described by Marx in his 1844 Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts. With this basic idea as a starting point, I then attempt to justify a list of these 10 capabilities as central requirements of a life with human dignity. These 10 capabilities are supposed to be general goals that can be further specified by the society in question as it works on the account of fundamental entitlements that it wishes to endorse. But in some form, all are supposed to be part of a minimum account of social justice, that is, a society that doesn't guarantee all these to its citizens at some appropriate threshold level falls short of being a fully just society, whatever its level of opulence. One way of implementing such a list would be through a written constitution with its account of fundamental rights, but this isn't a necessary feature of the idea. Moreover, the capabilities are held to be important for each and every person,
Each person is treated as an end and none as a mere adjunct or means to the ends of others. And although in practical terms priorities may have to be set temporarily, the capabilities are understood as both mutually supportive and as all of central importance to social justice. Thus, a society that neglects one of them to promote the others has shortchanged its citizens in ethically salient ways, and there's a failure of justice in the shortchanging. Of course, someone may feel that one or more of the capabilities on my actual list should not enjoy that central status, but then she'll be differing with me about what ought to be on the list, not about the more general project of using such a list to define a minimal conception of social justice. The list itself is open-ended and undergoes modification. No doubt it will continue to undergo modification in the light of criticism, but you have the current text. Now, because considerations of pluralism and cultural variety have been on my mind since the beginning, I've worked a sensitivity to cultural difference into my understanding of the list in several ways, and I'll mention six now. First of all, I do consider the list as genuinely subject to ongoing revision and rethinking, in the way that any society's account of its most fundamental entitlements is always subject to supplementation and or deletion. I also insist, second, that the items on the list ought to be specified in a somewhat abstract and general way, as they are on your list, precisely in order to leave room for the activities of specifying and deliberating by citizens and their legislatures and courts that I talk about in some length in the book. Within certain parameters, it's perfectly appropriate that different nations should do that specifying somewhat differently, taking their own particular histories and special circumstances into account. Thus, for example, a free speech right that suits Germany and its special history well, in which certain political parties, for example, anti-Semitic parties, can be deemed violative of the Constitution and their freedom to assemble and their freedom of speech is to some extent impeded by being declared illegal. That free speech right that suits Germany's circumstances might well be too restrictive in the different climate of the U.S., where indeed the right of neo-Nazis peaceably to assemble and demonstrate has been upheld as constitutionally protected. Third, I consider the list to be a freestanding so-called partial moral conception, to use John Rawls's phrase from his book Political Liberalism. That is, it explicitly is introduced for political purposes only and without any grounding in metaphysical ideas of the sort that divide people along lines of culture and religion. As Rawls says, we can view this list as a kind of ethical module that can be latched onto different comprehensive conceptions of the good and thus can be endorsed by people who otherwise have very different conceptions of the ultimate meaning and purpose of life. They will connect to it with their religious or secular comprehensive doctrines in many ways. Here again, by the way, another commonality with international human rights approaches. In the origins of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you can see from Marianne Glendon's excellent recent book, people explicitly theorized the list that way, that it was a list that people with different religious comprehensive doctrines could agree to as a practical political list. Fourth, if we insist that the appropriate political target is capability and not actual functioning, we protect pluralism here again. Many people who are willing to support a given capability as a fundamental entitlement would feel profoundly violated were the associated functioning made basic. Thus, the right to vote can be endorsed by believing citizens who would feel deeply violated by mandatory voting because it goes against their religious conception. The American Amish are in this category. The Amish believe that it's wrong to participate in political life, even by voting, but they feel perfectly happy endorsing the right of all citizens to vote. The free expression of religion can be endorsed by many people who would totally object to any establishment of religion that would involve dragooning all citizens into some type of actual religious functioning. Fifth, the major liberties that protect pluralism are central items on the list: the freedom of speech, the freedom of association, the freedom of conscience. By placing them on the list, we give them a central and non-negotiable place. Sixth and finally, I insist on a rather strong separation between issues of justification and issues of implementation. I believe that we can justify this list as a good basis for political principles all around the world by a cogent argument. But this does not mean that we license thereby intervention with the affairs of a state that does not recognize them. It's a basis for persuasion, but I hold that military and economic sanctions are justified only in certain very grave circumstances involving traditionally recognized crimes against humanity. So it seems less objectionable to recommend something to everyone once we point out that it's part of the view that state sovereignty, grounded in the consent of the people, is a very important part of the whole package. Now, where does Sen stand on these questions? I find a puzzling tension in his writings at this point. On the one hand, he speaks as though certain capabilities are absolutely central and non-negotiable. One cannot read his discussions of health, education, political and civil liberties, and the free choice of occupation without feeling that he agrees totally with my view that these human capabilities should enjoy a strong priority and should be made central by states the world over as fundamental entitlements of each and every citizen, although he says very little about how a threshold level of each capability would be constructed. In the case of liberty, he's actually written an article endorsing giving the traditional political liberties a considerable priority, though without giving an exhaustive enumeration of the liberties that would fall under that principle. His role in the formulation of the measures that go into the human development reports, moreover, clearly shows him endorsing a group of health and education-related capabilities as normative benchmarks, as the appropriate way to measure quality of life across nations. On the other hand, Sen has conspicuously refused to endorse any account of the central capabilities. Thus, the examples I've just mentioned remain in limbo. Clearly, they're examples of some things he thinks very important, but it's not clear to what extent he's prepared to recommend them as important goals for all the world's societies, goals connected with the idea of social justice itself. And it's equally unclear whether there might not be other capabilities not mentioned so often that might be equally important, and if so, what those capabilities might be. The reason for this appears to be, and this is what he has said in discussing this paper with me, his respect for democratic deliberation. He feels that people should be allowed to settle these matters for themselves. Now, of course, as I've just said, I do too, in the sense of implementation. But Sen goes further, suggesting that democracy is inhibited by the very endorsement of a set of central entitlements in international political debate, as when feminists insist on certain requirements of gender justice in international documents and deliberative fora. In development of freedom, things become, I believe, even more problematic. For Sen speaks throughout this book of what he calls the perspective of freedom, and uses language again and again, suggesting that freedom is a central, all-purpose social good, a general such good, and that capabilities are to be seen as instances of this more general good of human freedom. Such a view is not incompatible with ranking some freedoms ahead of others, for political purposes, of course, but it does seem to go in a problematic direction. First of all, it's unclear whether the idea of promoting freedom across the board is even a coherent political project. Some freedoms limit others. The freedom of very rich people to make large campaign contributions limits the equal worth of the right to vote. The freedom of businesses to pollute the environment limits the freedom of citizens to enjoy an unpolluted environment. The freedom of big landowners to keep their land limits projects of land reform that might be argued to be central to many freedoms of the poor, and were so argued in the Indian founding, and so on. Obviously, these freedoms are not among the ones that Sen considers, but he says nothing to limit the account of freedom or to rule out conflicts of this type. Furthermore, even if there were a coherent project that viewed all freedoms as desirable social goals, it's not at all clear that this is the sort of project someone with Sen's political and ethical views ought to endorse. The examples I've just given show us that any political project that's going to protect the equal worth of certain basic liberties for the poor and to improve their living conditions needs to say forthrightly that some freedoms are central for political purposes and some are distinctly not. Some freedoms involve basic social entitlements based on justice, and others do not. Some lie at the heart of a view of political justice, and others do not. Among the ones that do not lie at the core, some are simply less important, but others may be positively bad. For example, the freedom of rich people to make large campaign contributions, though defended by many Americans in the name of the general good of freedom, seems to me not among those freedoms that lie at the heart of a set of basic entitlements to which a just society should commit itself. In many circumstances, it's actually a bad thing, and constraint on it, as by the recent legislation, a very good thing. Similarly, the freedom of industry to pollute, though cherished and defended legally by many Americans in the name of the general good of freedom, seems to me not among those freedoms that should enjoy protection. Beyond a certain point, the freedom to pollute is bad and should be constrained and is constrained by law. And while property rights are certainly a good thing up to a point and in some ways, the freedom of the large feudal zamindars in India to hold on to their estates, a freedom that some early Supreme Court decisions did hold to enjoy constitutional protection, wrongly in my view and in the view of subsequent court decisions, is not part of the account of property rights as central human entitlements that a just society would want to endorse. To define property capabilities so broadly as to include those rights is actually a bad thing, because land reform can be essential to social justice. To speak more generally, gender justice cannot be successfully pursued without limiting male freedom. For example, the so-called right to have intercourse with one's wife, whether she consents or not, has been understood as a cherished male prerogative in most societies of the world, and men have greatly resented the curtailment of liberty that followed from laws against marital rape, one reason why about half the states in the United States still do not treat non-consensual intercourse within marriage as genuine rape, and why many societies the world over utterly lack laws against it. The freedom to harass women in the workplace is a cherished prerogative of males the world over. The minute sexual harassment regulations are introduced or even contemplated, one always hears protests invoking the idea of liberty. Terms like femi-Nazis are used to suggest that feminists are against liberty for supporting these policies. And of course, in one sense, feminists are indeed insisting on a restriction of liberty on the grounds that those liberties are inimical both to equality and to women's other liberties and opportunities. In short, no society that pursues equality or even an ample social minimum can avoid curtailing people's freedom in very many ways. And what it ought to say is those freedoms are not good. They're not part of a core group of entitlements required by the notion of social justice. And indeed, in many ways, they subvert those core entitlements. Of other freedoms, for example, the freedom of motorcyclists to drive around without helmets, they could say these freedoms are not terribly important. They're neither very bad nor very good. They're not implicit in our account of social justice, but they don't appear to subvert it either. In other words, all societies that pursue a reasonably just political conception have to evaluate human freedoms, saying that some are central and some trivial, some good and some actively bad. This evaluation also affects the way we will assess the abridgment of a freedom. Certain freedoms are taken to be entitlements of citizens based on justice. When any one of these is abridged, that's an especially grave failure of the political system. In such cases, people rightly feel that the abridgment is not just a large cost to be borne, it's a cost of a distinctive kind involving a violation of basic justice. When some freedom outside the core is abridged, that may be a small cost or it may be a large cost to some actor or actors, but it is not a cost of exactly that same kind, namely one that injustice no citizen should be asked to bear. This qualitative difference is independent of the amount of cost, at least as figured in terms of standard subjective willingness to pay models. Thus, motorcyclists may mind very greatly a law that tells them to put on a helmet, and they may feel that it wrecks their lives. Many of them do. In terms of standard willingness to pay models, they might be willing to pay quite a lot for the right to drive without a helmet. Indeed, if we think about the issue of sexual harassment, many men certainly do feel that constraint on their freedom in the workplace, their freedom to approach women in ways that are defined as harassment, is a big limitation and a large cost to be borne. And many would be willing to pay quite a lot to continue to have the freedom to approach women in that way in the workplace. On the other side, many citizens probably would not think that not being able to vote was a terribly big cost. In terms of willingness to pay, at least, they would not pay much to be able to vote, and some may actually have to be paid for voting. And yet, I would want to say, and I think on reflection most people would also, that the right to vote is a fundamental entitlement based upon justice, whereas the right to drive without a helmet is not, and then I think there'd be less agreement on the sexual harassment one, but we could at least argue that one. Sen's response to these questions in discussion has been to say that freedom per se is always good, although it can be badly used. Freedom, he says, is like male strength. Male strength is per se a good thing, although it can be badly used, namely used to beat up women. Now, I'm not fully satisfied by this reply, for obviously enough, so much depends on how one specifies the content of the freedom in question. Some freedoms include injustice in their very definition. Thus, the freedom to rape one's wife without penalty, the freedom to hang out a sign saying no blacks here, the freedom of an employer to discriminate on grounds of race or sex or religion. Those are freedoms, all right, and some people zealously defend them. Indeed, my libertarian colleagues, with whom I associate every day, give many examples of the defense of such freedoms. But it seems absurd to say that these things are good per se and bad only in use. Any society that allows people these freedoms has allowed a fundamental injustice involving the subordination of a vulnerable group. Of other freedoms, for example, the freedom of the motorcycle rider to ride around without a helmet, we should not say good in itself, bad only in use. We should say neutral and pretty trivial in itself, whether maybe good, maybe bad in use. Once again, attention to the all-important issue of content is vital. I would argue that Sen really can't avoid committing himself to a core list of the fundamental capabilities once he faces such questions. If capabilities are to be used in advancing a conception of social justice, they will obviously have to be specified, if only in the open-ended and humble way that I've outlined. Either a society has a conception of justice or it does not. If it has one, we have to know what its content is, what opportunities and liberties it takes to be fundamental entitlements of all citizens. One cannot have a conception of basic social justice that says simply all citizens are entitled to freedom understood as capability. Besides being misleading in the ways I've already argued, such a blanket endorsement of freedom as capability, as a social goal, would be hopelessly vague. It would be impossible to say whether any given society was just or unjust. Someone may now say, sure, there has to be a definite list in the case of each nation that's striving for justice, but why not leave the list making to them? Of course, as I've already said, in the sense of implementation and also in the sense of more precise specification, I do so. So to be a real objection to my proposal, the question must be, why should we hold out to all nations a set of norms that we believe justified by a good philosophical argument, as when feminists work out norms of sex equality in documents such as CEDAW, rather than letting each nation justify its own set of norms? The answer to this question, however, is given, I think, in all of Sen's work, namely, some human matters are too important to be left to whim and caprice, or even to the dictates of a cultural tradition. To say that education for women or adequate health care is not justified ethically, just in case some nation believes that it's not justified, seems like a capitulation to subjective preferences of the sort that Sen has opposed throughout his career. As he's repeatedly stated, capabilities have intrinsic importance, not just an importance deriving from actual preferences. But if we believe that, we also believe that it's right to say to nations that don't sufficiently recognize one of them, you know, you too should endorse equal education for girls and understand it as a fundamental entitlement. You too should provide a certain level of health care to all citizens and view this as among their fundamental constitutional entitlements. Just because the U.S. does not choose to recognize a fundamental right to health care, that does not make the U.S. morally right or justified. In short, it makes sense to take the issue of social justice seriously and to use a norm of justice to assess the various nations of the world and their practices. But if this issue of social justice is important, then the content of a conception of justice is also important. Social justice has always been a profoundly normative matter, and its role is typically critical. We work out an account of what is just, and we then use it to find reality deficient in various ways. Sen's whole career has been devoted to developing norms of justice in exactly this way and holding them up against reality to produce valuable criticisms. It seems to me that his commitment to normative critical thinking about justice requires the endorsement of some definite content. One cannot say, I'm for justice, but any conception of justice any nation comes up with is all right with me. Moreover, Sen, of course, does not say that. He's a radical thinker who has taken a definite and radical stand on many matters, including matters of sex equality, in ways that go well apart from the actual traditions of the nations of the world. He's never been afraid to be definite when misogyny is afoot, or to supply a quite definite account of why most societies are defective. So it's somewhat mysterious to me why he's recently moved in the direction of endorsing freedom as a general good. Certainly, there's no such retreat in his practical writings regarding women. In recent writings, such as his article this year called The Many Faces of Misogyny, he's extremely definite about what is just and unjust in laws and institutions in a variety of countries, and one can infer a rich account of fundamental human entitlements from this critique. But then it would appear that he cannot actually believe that the content of an account of fundamental entitlements should be left up for grabs. Such leaving up for grabs is all the more dangerous when we're confronting issues of women's equality. For obviously enough, many traditional conceptions of social justice and fundamental entitlements have made women second-class citizens, if citizens at all. Women's liberties, opportunities, property rights, and political rights have been construed as unequal to those of men, and this has been taken to be a fully just state of affairs. Nor have traditional accounts of justice attended at all to issues that are particularly urgent for women, such as bodily integrity in the home, sexual harassment in the workplace, and issues that are very fundamental, which I include in the longer version of this paper but didn't have time to include here, the issue of public support for care to children, the disabled, and the elderly, work most of which is done by women in many nations of the world and is a big source of impediment to women's full equality as citizens. Now, some supporters of a capabilities approach might still be reluctant to endorse a list because of concerns about pluralism. But here, in addition to what I've already said about the way I work pluralism into the conception, we may make two further points that pertain specifically to this norm of respect for pluralism. First, the value of respect for pluralism itself requires a commitment to some cross-cultural principles as fundamental entitlements. Real respect for pluralism means strong and unwavering protection for religious freedom, for the freedom of association, for the freedom of speech. If we say that we're for pluralism and yet refuse to commit ourselves to the non-negotiability of these items as fundamental building blocks of a just political order, we show that we're actually half-hearted about pluralism. I'm sure that Sen would agree with this, and indeed his article on the priority of liberty strongly says this. I'm sure, too, that he would say the same about other items on my list, such as health and education. If a nation says that they're for the human capabilities, but refuses to give these special protection for all citizens, citing reasons of cultural or religious pluralism, Sen will surely say that they're not making a good argument or giving genuine protection to pluralism. Instead, they are very often denying people, often women in particular, the chance to figure out what culture and form of life they actually want. So they're actually curtailing the most meaningful kind of pluralism, which requires having a life of one's own and some choices regarding it. And that goal surely requires a certain level of basic health and education. But then, we're both in effect making a list of such entitlements, and the only question then must be what shall go on the list and how long it shall be. The second argument is one that derives from the Rawlsian idea of political liberalism, and I'm not certain that Sen would endorse it. The argument says that classical liberalism went wrong by endorsing freedom or autonomy as a general good in human life. Both earlier liberals, such as John Stuart Mill, and modern comprehensive liberals, such as Joseph Raz, hold that autonomy and freedom of choice are essential ingredients in valuable human lives, and that society is therefore entitled to promote autonomy across the board in its choice of public policies. Rawls, and I with him, hold that this general endorsement of autonomy shows deficient respect for citizens whose comprehensive conception of the good human life do not make freedom and autonomy central human values. People who belong to an authoritarian religion, for example, cannot agree with John Stuart Mill that autonomy is a generally central thing. Mill responds in Chapter 3 of On Liberty by denigrating such people. He understands Calvinists to be such people, and he says that they have a cramped and starved and pinched conception of human life. And clearly, it's his view, the public policy would be entitled, without curtailing their freedom of speech, to discourage that. So presumably, the Millian state would denigrate them too, and would design educational and other institutions to disfavor that conception, although their civil liberties would not be restricted. Rawls and I agree that this strategy shows deficient respect for a reasonable pluralism of different comprehensive conceptions of the good human life. We should respect people who prefer an authoritarian religion or a similarly hierarchical personal relationship so long as certain basic opportunities and exit options are firmly guaranteed. I hold that this respect for pluralism is fostered both by making capability and not functioning the appropriate political goal, and also by endorsing a relatively small list of core capabilities for political purposes. Thus, we say two things to religious citizens. We say first that endorsing the capabilities list doesn't require them to endorse the associated functioning as a good in their own lives, a point that I've stressed by talking about the Amish. And we say second that the very fact that this is a short and finite list shows that we're leaving them lots of room to value other things, and including hierarchical things, in mapping out their plan of life. We do not ask them to endorse freedom as a general good, as we might seem to do if we talk a lot about freedom in the way of Sen's latest book, but fail to make a short and definite list. Instead, we just ask them to endorse this short list of freedoms as capabilities for political purposes and as applicable to all citizens. They may then get on with the lives that they prefer. The expectation is that a Roman Catholic citizen, say, can endorse this short list of fundamental liberties for political purposes without feeling that her view of church authority and its decisive role in her life is thereby being denigrated. Even an Amish citizen who believes that all participation in public life is simply wrong can still feel that it's all right to endorse the capabilities list for political purposes, because no general endorsement of autonomy as an all-purpose goal tells her that her life is less worthwhile than other lives. And, as I argued in Women and Human Development, even a woman who believes that the veiling of women is right according to her religious conception may endorse this small menu of liberties and opportunities as available to all women, though she herself will use few of them, and she will feel, I think, that the conception is one that respects her, because it does not announce that only autonomous lives are worthwhile. Now, I'm not certain whether Sen is in this sense a comprehensive liberal like Mill and Raz, or a political liberal like Rawls and me, and in fact, he's explicitly not commented on this particular point. But to the extent that he finds Rawls's arguments on this score persuasive, he has yet a further reason, I believe, to endorse a definite and relatively short, circumscribed list of capabilities as political goals, rather than to praise freedom as a general social good. The question of how to frame such a list and what to put on it is surely a difficult one in many ways, requiring much international debate, and also, at every stage, a complicated and delicate balance between radical commitment and cultural sensitivity. But I've argued that there's no way to take the capabilities approach forward, making it really productive for political thought about basic social justice, without facing this question and giving it the best answer one can, even if we know that any such account will always be contested and remade. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for that very powerful presentation of your argument. We now have a half an hour available for questions, so I'm open to you for...
Are we going to do one at a time or take it?
I think we'll start with one at a time. Yeah. There is a mic, I think, if you want to just...
I actually was hoping you would speak a bit more on your last point. You've used the pronoun we to denote who's responsible for creating justice norms, and you've emphasized that your list is humble and revisable. So I'm wondering, who is the we responsible for revising this list? What is the process by which they might go about that? And in particular, I'm asking this in light of your reference to the importance of adaptive preferences, particularly in relation to women.
Mm-hmm. It's a very good and important question. I mean, in the first instance, I go along with Rawls in thinking that the process of reflecting about social justice is a profoundly Socratic one, that each person is examining him or herself and trying to come up with something that seems worthy of being held out as a good norm in these areas. And of course, he adds, and I would agree with this, that this process ultimately involves not just trading, going back and forth between your considered convictions and the normative conception that you're working out, but then confronting that in turn with the major conceptions that have been developed in the history of the topic, which he hopes will, that process over time will be sufficient if it's pursued carefully and with enough self-criticism to root out the most common sources of cultural bias and error. But of course, like Rawls, I think this process is ongoing and open-ended and might never be completed in such a way that we would say we've really got it. Now then, when we're talking about recommending something as a basis for political justice in a society, then there's a further set of constraints that enter in, that is the agreement that we can hope to establish with others. Now this, of course, will have many different levels in the current world situation, as within each nation one tries to work out an account of entitlements, and also in the international realm where you try to work with other people on getting an international document together, and if it had ultimately any official status, then there would be ways in which nations could either incorporate it, ratify it, or not. So right now, what I think is this is just a proposal that I'm contemplating, asking people's views about, hoping to work on it and make it better. But what I also think is that even at this early stage, when, you know, I mean, I think there are really three stages in doing that. One is to try to assemble enough information to start the process. Then the second would be to work out your own conception. Then the third would be the Rawlsian one of confronting it systematically with all the other different conceptions. Even at the very first stage, you gotta listen a lot, and preferably to people unlike yourself as much as possible. And my way, chosen way of doing that was to think a lot about one country, because I thought that, I mean, obviously, if you're talking about development, you have to focus on developing countries. But I was unsatisfied by some work that I had seen which pulls in decontextualized, dehistoricized examples from lots of different countries. So I decided that I would try to get to know development issues in India as well as possible, spend a lot of time there, go around with development workers and see what they were doing. Now, that, you know, initially I thought of as just me trying to inform myself well enough that I could even have the beginning of searching into myself for the best account that I could then propose to others and ask what they think of it. But it seemed to me in the end that there was another way that we opened up here, which was pertinent, and that is this, that in the international arena, there are, of course, powerful theories that are on the scene being put forward by actors, often economists, which propose norms that are being acted on for development. At the same time, there are norms that in women's groups of various kinds in India, but presumably elsewhere as well, women are actually striving for, and they're theorizing at their grassroots level. And these norms often have little impact because these women are illiterate and they haven't theorized it in a way that gets recognition at the level of an institution like the IMF or the World Bank. So then I began to think, well, another thing I'm doing here, let's hope, or I would like to seek to do, is to become an ally of such women who have often gone through already some process of critical reflection extremely well in the women's groups. They are often formed around ideas of consciousness raising and Paulo Freire's pedagogy of the oppressed. And I want to be there, as it were, a rapporteur and advocate in the corridors of power, in the sense that if you have an academic version of something and you theorize it in an academic way, that gives it a way that it can go up against the, I think, deficient conceptions of the economists in a way that those women just aren't going to have a chance to do. So I also think that even though, of course, it's just my thing and I'm just concocting it and I haven't even fully justified it in the course of time to myself, there is also a way in which it does, I hope, represent well the strivings of some others whose voices might not otherwise be heard. Now, of course, at that point, there's always the question, are you seeing the right people, and what about their preferences, and so on. And that's why in the book, the whole fourth of the book is devoted to informed desire approaches. What would one have to see in a winnowing of desire in order to feel satisfied that there ought to be a convergence between that and the ethical proposal that one's prepared to justify independently with an independent moral argument? And I think a lot about the structure of development groups in doing that. That is, certain things that Paulo Freire recommended, such as freedom from intimidation, freedom from hierarchy, seem to me very important structures in shaping a group such that the values that emerge from it would be adequate to be free from adaptive preferences and so on. So that's a very complicated answer to your question, but I actually believe that it offers us a further reason to talk in terms of a definite content, because the trouble is that there is a very definite content that's being pushed all the time, and it's a very narrow one, and that is just economic growth as the end of development. And unless we say in a very concrete way, oh no, what women are striving for includes maybe a greater economic well-being, but it includes lots of other things that are quite separate from that, such as their own dignity, their political participation, education, and so on, then that gives us a reason to get specific as to the set of things that we're pushing for in order to contrast it with other theories. So the we, I think, ultimately, even though I take responsibility for it as just my own concoction at this point, I would hope that it also does give voice to people who maybe their own voices aren't sufficiently heard.
I just had two questions for you. The first was about the list of capabilities. I wasn't sure whether they're universal or not, because you seem to imply on the one hand that you should ask countries to give education to women regardless of their cultural beliefs and so on. Then capabilities are flexible enough to allow countries to have to show their own cultural differences. For instance, Germany interpreting freedom of speech in its own way. So I'm confused about whether they are universal values in a sense or not. My second question is about, just to pick up on your point about the conflicting tensions between people's freedoms and rights, and you mentioned the example of a wealthy person's right to give money to a political campaign, denigrating the right to vote as something that gives equality. But surely this shows that the language of rights and even capabilities is unable to resolve equality, that there's a limitation on that language, and that the formal aspects of that can't be realized, the content of it can't be realized, and that, just looking down your list, the right to vote, the right to have freedom of speech, those are rights that actually people aren't arguing for right now. The content of it isn't even being discussed, and it's almost like we may give people these formalistic documents, but who's arguing for it? The attack on civil liberties right now, there doesn't seem to be a group in society really that's really pushing against that. So is it more that rather than not being able to work out a document and a list that makes sense and that is viable, is that society itself is not actually that interested in freedom or even in equality? There isn't a vision, or in Russell Jacoby's words, a utopia that everybody is engaged in trying to produce.
Okay, about the first one, I think there is a legitimate area within which societies may reasonably pursue different paths in keeping with their own histories. And then there's also doing it wrong and going too far. And it's a delicate matter, which I think you then have to just get very concrete and say why and so on. But it seems to me, and I'd be prepared to argue this at greater length, that Germany's restrictions on the freedom of speech in the light of its history are legitimate different specifications of a free speech right that the U.S. has specified with extremely inclusive protection for all forms of political speech. Of course, it didn't used to be that way, and Ernst Freund, who was the founder of our law school, whose chair I'm very proud to hold, he was the first person in 1920 who argued that the political speech of dissidents during wartime was protected by the First Amendment. So this is a relatively new understanding, but anyway, it is the dominant understanding. I do think, however, that not just anything a country does in the name of coming up with its own account is all right. To give you one very striking recent example, the criminal jailing, the criminal fining of Arundhati Roy for her speeches about the Supreme Court on grounds, I mean, there is this offense of criminal contempt that allows interference with an amazing amount of free speech. That seems to me to go much too far in permitting very important areas of political dissent to be just simply criminalized, and in her case, they were. So, I mean, you'd have to give arguments pertinent to the political case to say why it goes too far, but I think then you do it by talking about the purpose of the protection of free speech in a democracy, what role that right really serves, and you try to show that while in the case of Germany, restricting these fringe neo-Nazi parties may not undermine the general goals of political democracy, the particular restrictions on Arundhati Roy's speech do, but that would take a while. As to the way that freedoms limit other freedoms, well, yes, I mean, this was, I used that example of the campaign contribution and the equal right to vote to show that if we simply say freedom is the goal, then it's not only hopeless, but dubiously even coherent, because freedoms are all the time limiting each other. What would it mean to pursue freedom in that way as a goal? With the capabilities on my list, I don't think that the situation is that way at all. I don't really think that they do limit one another, and they're being carefully thought about to be a coherent set that at some reasonable threshold level can then be realized with for all citizens. Now, that doesn't mean that in the immediate circumstances that some society might find itself in, there might not be some conflicts, as when India is thinking of turning primary and secondary education into a fundamental constitutional entitlement, which would go along with my ideas on the list. If they do that, they will face a conflict with people's right to life and health in many poor areas where parents, in order to get their children educated, may have to forego their labor and therefore put their health and even life in a perilous position. But then you ask, well, why is that conflict there? Is that necessary in the nature of things, or is that the result of bad thinking and planning? And so here I think we look around and we notice that Kerala has managed to not kill off the parents, but yet to produce universal adolescent literacy. How has it done that? By intelligent planning, by flexible school hours, by compensating parents by a nutritious school lunch that in many ways offsets the costs to parents in the lost child labor. So in many ways, they've just thought well about that question and diffused the conflict. I do think that we have to think hard when we set the level of a fundamental entitlement about such conflict. So if we concluded, looking around us, that there are two entitlements, let's say a given level of environmental protection that we specify under number 8 on my list, all the time produces very pervasive conflicts with other capabilities, we might think, well, we've set the level wrong. I mean, so setting the level should always be done with some, as it were, horizontal look across to what will make the whole scheme coherent to realize. However, when you do that, it shouldn't be done with a short-sighted, in a short-sighted way, or in a way that capitulates to entrenched bad planning, or else India would simply say, oh, well, primary, secondary, and even primary education, not a feasible basic entitlement, because look at all the trouble it causes in our current situation. So you have to think, in the long term, would it be possible, given reasonable expectation of resources, and given good intelligent planning, to realize these as a coherent set? And so that's part of the way that you would, I think, specify a given right. You don't want to have a set that would be, if realized, terribly unstable, because I think stability, as I say elsewhere, is another political value that you want to promote. So you'd also want to think, when you set the level, would this allow an unreasonable amount of instability? And I do think that that's why Germany has set the level where it has with regard to the freedom of speech, not just because it thinks it's morally right, but because it thinks the role of these parties is destabilizing in a way that threatens all the other capabilities. So you take all that into account when you set the level, but then in the end you still have to think in a long term and in an ambitious, so not utopianism, but ambition. And so it's a fine line between those two. But I think the case of Kerala shows that difference.
I think I'll take questions in groups of three now.
Okay.
It's just a clarificatory question. I'm left very unclear as to the conception of freedom that you endorse and the relationship between freedom and rights. Do you hold the following view, namely that I am free to do something to the extent that I have the right to do that thing? And of course, depending on your reply to that question, I may have an objection.
Thank you. May I ask two questions about the nature of your justification of capability? You came to that your approach is quite similar to Woolf's political liberalism and says that capability is freestanding and mutual. But in Woolf's idea, the political conception of justice is based on the public culture of a kind of democratic society. And my first question is, how can you justify the capability in a universal sense, because I think that you seem to argue some kind of capability is non-relative to different cultures. Yes. And to defend this position, I think you either have to presuppose a conception of a person or a conception of well-being. And how can it be freestanding in that case? Mm-hmm. My second question is about the priority of capability. You, in your list, you just provide different capabilities, but these capabilities can conflict with each other in a particular situation. Then you have to face the priority problem. Then if you want to rent or resolve the conflict between different capabilities, then I think you need to appeal to a higher order conception of well-being or the conception of person to resolve that. For example, in Woolf's case, when he justified the priority of liberty, he appeals to the conception of person who have two higher order interests. So in your case, I'm not sure how can it be freestanding or neutral.
Can you pass it to just two rows behind you?
Thank you. I wonder also a bit about the list. You said it's negotiable what is on the list, but it is important to have a list. So I wonder what is the practical implication for that. For example, would you endorse that the present convent on a constitution for the European Union would set up such a list and, for example, make it an entry criteria for countries in each next step of enlargement that countries sign that list? The problem would be, of course, that the incumbents have drawn up that list while the accession countries were not participants in that process. And even if they would sign, how about going about the problem that they may just sign it and then do not act upon it?
Okay. To Cecile's question, I don't know if we can. I don't really use the word freedom a lot. That's the word that Sen uses it a lot. I'd rather use the word capability, meaning being in a position actually to choose the relevant functioning, or as the case may be, not to pursue it. Now, I do not think that one has that capability or freedom understood as capability just in case there's a right to that thing that exists in some document. That's the whole point of the critique of the rights, or limited critique of the rights conception. That is, I think that you have the capability only in the case you're actually in a position to go out and do something. And in my view, that it has three layers. You have to have, as it were, some equipment that you came into the world with, or you're never going to get to that level. That's what I call basic capabilities. You then got to have the development of that through suitable education, emotional support, affiliation,
so that you get to be, as it were, internally ready to do that, and that's what I call internal capabilities. But then you could have that, as most people in the world have the internal capability for thought and speech in accordance with their conscience, and still the world around you doesn't let you actually exercise that. And so you have to also have the material and institutional environment that's favorable. So all of that is involved in the analysis of when it's actually realized. Okay, yes, the Rawls question. This is a very subtle and good question. I mean, first of all, I would just one small point, that by freestanding, neither I nor, I believe, Rawls would want to say neutral. I mean, neutral, it's not morally neutral, and it ends up entailing that some conceptions are unreasonable and others are not, and so on. So just with that caveat in mind, I think that Rawls has retreated in an unfortunate way by saying that the freestanding conception has to be justified in terms of a conception that's part of the shared public culture of people with a specific Western history. In Theory of Justice, he thought it derived from an idea of the inviolability of the person, which, while Kantian, was one that one could come to intuitively from many different kinds of starting points, and he didn't think of it as peculiarly Western. And I think he needn't have. I mean, people can have the conception of the person and its dignity, and do have, in every culture of the world without having a specific Western history. Now, I do think that you need, as well as the conception, you need something like a political conception of the person, but not necessarily a metaphysical conception of the person. Let's hope it's a useful, as of course Rawls's own conception is supposed to be, a so-called freestanding conception of the person, in the sense that it's non-metaphysical and it's yet used at many points in the conception. Unlike his constructivist one, I would rather, for reasons having to do with the treatment of the desire I have not to split off animality from rationality, but the desire to see a dignity in our animality itself, I prefer one that's, I think of it as more Aristotelian in spirit, that is, that thinks of the political person as a mortal animal as well. But in any case, I think there are intuitive foundations for the conception of the person that you can find from many different religious and secular starting points, and you don't have to take stands on such divisive matters as, is the person immortal or not, and so on. So I think that you can have both the freestanding conception and the freestanding conception of the person within it, without getting entangled in divisive metaphysics. At least that's my hope. Now, the hierarchy issue, I guess I think this, that if the levels are set right, then it should, back to the other answer, it should all be coherent, but that actually before the fact, you may not know that. And so if you're a judge, I'm not as attached as Rawls is to principles that are final and settle conflicts before the fact. I'm open to a certain amount of intuitionistic balancing, and I think that's actually the function of the judiciary in a just society. So that if we take something like the famous case Wisconsin versus Yoder, where it looks like there's a conflict between the state's interest in educating all children and producing educational capabilities in those children, and the parents' desire to perpetuate their own religious conception. The Amish parents wanted to take their children out of public education at the age of 14 rather than the age of 16, arguing that their way of life would go under and therefore their free exercise, it was brought as a free exercise case by the parents, would be impeded if the whole culture collapsed by the lack of suitable religious education of the children, which required farm work and seemed to them to be incompatible with public education. Now, on the one hand, it would have been unreasonable, I believe, and it's just a non-starter, if they had said, well, we want no education of the children. And I think it would have been quite reasonable to just say our understanding of fundamental entitlements is that all children are entitled to a certain amount of education because that's a prerequisite of meaningful exit options, choice of a way of life, etc. On the other side, it might seem unduly severe if we said, well, there's no flexibility at all. Your religious conception gives you no dispensation from laws of general applicability. Now, that is a position that is currently basically the position of the U.S. courts in the aftermath of the very unfortunate decision about the Native Americans' use of peyote in their sacred ceremony. And oddly, it's Scalia, who you might think of as a defender of religion, but he's also a legal rule person, and he really thinks there should be no exemptions from laws of general applicability when a religious claim is in view. Now, I think both in the case of the Native Americans using peyote in their sacred ceremony and in the case of the Amish parents wanting to take their children out at age 14, these are legitimate requests to set the level in a flexible way, in such a way that allows for carving out areas of exemption when another important capability is at issue. Once again, we can't say before the case, how and how far that's rightly done. And I think that, although I think the peyote case is a pretty clear case that they ought to be allowed to do that, I think the Yoder case is actually a very unclear case, because among other things, there was a sex equality issue for the girls as to they were being cut out of useful job training by going back to work in the home in a way that the boys were not cut out from useful job training by doing the carpentry and farm work that they were going to be doing when they weren't in school. So, I think it's a very tough case, and therefore whether it was rightly decided, but I think it's right that in a conception where you're juggling multiple capabilities, you would have such tough cases. And I think what you want to say there is not, we see how the capabilities are pervasively intentioned, so you can't fulfill them all. We say instead, we know that it's always hard to say whether in a given instance we've set the levels right or carved out the exemptions in the right way. But if we have done so, then the whole thing is perfectly coherent.
I want to ask you a question about autonomy and respect for authoritarian or hierarchical religion. It seemed, you said that you were with Rawls and you were not with Mill and Raz, slightly to my disappointment. I thought, you actually, it seems to me, if I may say so, you seem to me to equivocate, because your sixth capability, practical reason, is being able to form a conception of the good and to engage in critical reflection about the planning of one's life. That looks to me very much like autonomy. And so that my first question is really, why is that not autonomy? But then I want to ask you about how you deal with respecting authoritarian and hierarchical religions. I mean, what does this consist in? And how do we distinguish between a case where in such a religion you might have adaptive preferences or autonomous acceptance of the hierarchy and the authority?
Hello, I wanted to ask a question which perhaps is tangential to the way that most of the questions have unfolded. I'm interested in degrees of embeddedness, really. And the question I'm asking is, what is the potential?
What would be the benefit to the state to spend resources on providing people with these capabilities? Because I would imagine that many states would feel that it is a threat to them to allow people to think, imagine, and feel the way that they would, because they would use their education systems or a conspicuous lack of education to keep people not in the know and to keep them able to think what they can and cannot do so that they maintain their own stability. So what would you argue as the benefit to the state for instilling these capabilities in their people?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay, let me start with that. I guess what I think is that, of course, I mean, one thing you can already see is that insofar as the human development approach of the UNDP has bought this, it has then been exported into thinking about development in lots of countries around the world, so that right now every country pretty well is making its own human development report and often comparing different regions and different states and so on within the country on this perspective. And, it has a, of course, just a measurement aspect, but it also has a normative aspect because each country wants to be higher up than it was before and so on. So that's one way it's already been working in. And this, of course, can interact in many ways with the political process in each country. And I do think it's such thinking about human development. The UNDP in India is a particularly powerful part of the UNDP. In fact, it was selected by UNDP worldwide to be the author of the gender and governance report for the whole of UNDP. And, you know, I think that's part of the push to focus on female education in, and to constitutionalize it as a basic entitlement. So that's one way, you know, that this might work its way into the political process. Another way would be through international documents. I mean, I would expect that a document, whether it would be one in Europe or some other, an international document might be formed that showed the influence of that kind of thinking and thinking about a set of issues that are on the table, whether they're women's issues and or environmental issues. And we can see, as in the case of CEDAW, which already, of course, is incorporates a lot of the things that I care about, that that's not just persuasive merely, but countries that ratify it, then it can have some teeth because courts have interpreted the ratification to be binding on the nation. In India, for example, there was a sexual harassment case where the sexual harassment guidelines in CEDAW were held to be binding on the nation through its ratification of the treaty. In Botswana, there was a similar nationality case. So increasingly, CEDAW and sometimes the Universal Declaration are being used as binding on state actors through their own endorsement of that. So I would hope that kind of thing would happen more and more. So I just hope that at a variety of levels it would become become meaningful in the international arena. More important, I think, the whole idea of capabilities. You know, I mean, and here's where I think Sen may rightly feel it doesn't matter too much exactly what you put on the list, but just to move the discussion in the right direction is what he wants to do, and get people thinking about human development with some of these values on it, is, and not just thinking about growth. And I think that has very much happened, largely through Sen's own influence in the World Bank and other agencies. That word is being used now, and not the other, not just the growth words. Now, the question about autonomy and practical reason, I actually think autonomy is a rather demanding philosophical notion, much more laden with specific freight than the conception of practical reason that I would endorse. And I think if you think about the Roman Catholic tradition, you can see this clearly, because there's no Catholic educator and so on who wouldn't say practical reason is one of the most important values that we want to form in a process of Catholic education, and yet the value of autonomy is in its origins explicitly anti-clerical, and it does mean rejecting the idea of a divine source for our norms and values. I think Jerry Schnawen's wonderful book on autonomy makes that difference very clear. So by practical reason, I mean something more humble, something that I think Roman Catholic citizens certainly have no trouble endorsing. More problematic is probably going to be some religions, and I think there are some varieties of Baptists who are such, who would actually hold that guiding your own life by your own reflective processes is not something that it's good to do, but you should go more by the rule book and by the tradition. Here, I think what we want to do is, first of all, point to the difference between capability and functioning. We're asking that all people have the capability, meaning that the material and social environment is prepared for them to do it, and, this is the divisive thing, that they have the education that prepares them to do it. So where the conflict will come with the Southern Baptist parent, as it has come in the U.S., is over the issue of whether public education may legitimately promote the reflective processes that make you able to think about other ways of life that you might possibly choose instead of the one you've got. And interestingly, the Supreme Court, I think, said just the right thing in this instance. There was a case called Mozart versus Hawkins. And the Southern Baptist parents wanted to take their children out of any part of the public education that taught them about other ways of life, and thereby promoting this kind of practical reason that I have in mind. And what the court says, well, you know, if you were living on your own, you could try to do that. But if you're in a pluralistic society, and it's a political value that we have here, that we ought to be able to think about one another and think about ways of life. And furthermore, children have interest in citizens and having a variety of paths open to them. So we're not going to give you what you want in that instance. Now, that does mean that certain religious conceptions will have to modify themselves if they want to go on as being regarded as reasonable conceptions within such a political order. It may be that according to that criterion, some of them will be judged to be unreasonable. But I think most of the recognized religions involve a role for practical reason up to that point, even though then they may want to say, you know, then when you're an adult,
just don't use it, but that's all right with me. Now, adaptive, you ask, I can't remember exactly how you put the point about adaptive preferences, but I mean, could you say again exactly what, how you, how would I know? I mean, obviously you don't always know what the hidden obstacles are, but by making capabilities a benchmark rather than either preferences or resources, you at least have some questions that you would ask. I mean, if you see, for example, that people, a lot of people are not voting, well, you want to know, is that because they just choose not to vote, or is there some hidden impediment to their being fully empowered? And I guess then if you notice that the distribution of not voting was along lines of traditional hierarchy connected with the formation of adaptive preferences, such as along lines of race, let's say, then you might well think there's a hidden obstacle here. And I mean, even someone as libertarian as Gary Becker does think that there's a loss of human capital, as he puts it, in a lack of political participation by African Americans that can be traced to discrimination, and then you'd have a reason to engage in affirmative public action to counter that. Again, if you notice, let's say that women are persistently forming relationships that involve violence and physical abuse. I mean, of course, it's always an extremely difficult question to know. And I mean, advocates for domestic violence victims have a very hard time on this. When to really say to a woman, you know, it's very important for you to leave this relationship. And if the woman says, well, you know, this is my life, and I love this man, and I want to stay. Now, I think the point that I would be prepared to go to is these things that are called no-drop laws, where if a woman brings a charge of domestic violence, she's not allowed to just drop it, but it has to be seen through the court, because we know so well that these cycles recur, and the man says, I love you, and everything looks like it's all right, but it's all based on intimidation and fear and lack of a sense of one's exit options. So that's one sort of thing you would want to do. You'd also want to guarantee options, real exit options, so that, again, to know whether a woman who's in sex work really has chosen that, and I am guardedly in favor of the decriminalization of prostitution, but I think the real issue there is that most women are not really choosing it. They have not enough education, not enough employment options, and so it's not a genuine choice. But if you have a wide array of options, that too would give you a sense that what you're dealing with is not a mere adaptive preference. But you'd have to ask all those questions, and it's often very difficult. Applicability to work organizations. I think that, you know, as I've just described it, the capabilities approach is, I've focused on the state and its fundamental constitutional entitlements or other account of fundamental entitlements. But I think NGOs of many kinds have a role in bringing those about. And one of the things I've just been starting at the University of Chicago, a center for studying the implementation of constitutional rights, because I think so often there is this agreement about what the document should be, but then a total lack of implementation in some key areas. And I think one of the things we want to study is the role that the nature of the legal system can play, the role that associations in civil society and NGOs can play, the role that even religions and other organizations can play in either impeding or promoting the implementation of rights, and finally, very importantly, the role that corporations could play, but usually don't, in the implementation of constitutional rights in the nations in which they do business. And so I don't know which organizations you have in mind, but I think both NGOs dealing with workers, such as, for example, the wonderful transnational organization of home-based female workers called Women in the Informal Economy, Globalizing and Organizing, that has a tremendously important role in implementing any of these capabilities for poor working women. And it was one of the founders of it is Marty Chen, who's done some of the most important practical work on capabilities approach. I also, though, think that work at a quite other level, that is the role of corporations, is something that needs to be studied and theorized much more than it has been. Okay, what's the payoff for the state in securing these capabilities? Well, I would just say, you know, when Mill asks himself the question, what do men get out of giving women these rights that the women are demanding? The first and most important thing is the good of having something that's universal and pervasive in human life regulated by justice rather than injustice. That was Mill's answer to that question, and it would be my answer to the other one. But, you know, at this point, I'm not averse to adding certain efficiency arguments that I think are true, that would say that states that do promote health and education are likely to have greater stability than ones that seal off from the capabilities a large number of their people. They'll also be likely to have greater economic success, and you know, obviously if 50% of your women can't read, as is still the case in India, there are economic opportunities that you're losing. And China, I mean, it sends writings about the difference between China and India have had that that rhetorical force, basically saying to the Indian state, look at all the things you've lost by not promoting literacy and health more aggressively. They also, as Sen's work on famine shows, protecting the political capabilities and liberties has a definite payoff in terms of the ground level well-being involved in avoiding famine, because it does turn out empirically that nations that have a free press and political and democratic political institutions have not had in recent times, since Indian independence, a major famine, whereas China did. So those are things that you can certainly say that are pretty clearly true.
Well, I know there are many more questions that people would like to ask, but I think we have to draw this to a close now. So I just ask you to join me again in thanking Martha Nussbaum for a